Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm joined on the podcast today by Lloyd Devereaux Richards, author of the new novel, Maidens of the Cave, and his daughter, Marguerite. Lloyd and Marguerite, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to be here, Jeff.
Absolutely. We'll talk about the unexpected success of your first novel, Stone Maidens, in a moment. But first, I wanted to ask you about your brand new novel. If someone hasn't yet heard about your novel, Maidens of the Cave, how would you describe the novel?
Well, first off, the lead protagonist in the book is a female FBI forensic scientist. Her name is Christine Prusik. It's set in the Midwest. Her offices are in Chicago, but she, as this book gets into, Chicago FBI office takes in a lot of the Midwestern states. And the particular novel, this is number two, the second novel, involves co-eds in a couple of several universities that turn up, their bodies turn up inside caves. And the only similar... They're not molested in any way, but they're the similar detail to the victims is this circular bruise in the back of their neck. She's brought in book two, Christine Prusik, to help with a local sheriff that she also helped in book one, because they had a very they successfully solved that crime. And she left without getting permission. This is one of her qualities. She, once she hears of a case and it's compelling to her, she frequently does not go up the chain of command and get permissions, etc. And there's a new boss that she has in the Chicago office, and this displeases the new boss very much. And so this, the book has this balance going between Christine is a personality, a difficult personality, and an intriguing forensic scientist, and, you know, the crime itself and how she gets pulled into it.
Do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to write Maidens of the Cave?
Well, actually, it's sort of a, in a sense, it stems from the first book in that I went to law school in Indiana. It's set in southern Indiana, as the first book is. And I went to law school in Bloomington, Indiana. And during that time period, I became aware of a series of crimes involving co-eds who, a lot of hardwood forests that have trails there. And there was a person I knew, a woman, who was attacked but survived. And the nature of her attack was similar when I met her at the hospital after she'd already been assisted. I heard from one of the state detectives investigating that it was very similar in nature to several unsolved murders. And I think that was the beginning of a kernel of my desire to write a book later when I moved to Vermont, where I live now, some years after leaving Indiana. That incident also caused this second book, because it also involves the death of co-eds, but it's a very different book qualitatively. But I think I was very impressed geographically with southern Indiana. I think a lot of, I'm from the East Coast originally, and I didn't know much about the Midwest, but having lived in this southern Indiana for 8 years, working for a judge after I graduated, I really came to love the middle of the United States. We have some of the most beautiful woods in the world. And so it was a great setting in my thinking for this book.
Well, your first novel, Stone Maidens, was published in 2012, but something completely unexpected happened to you and the novel earlier this year. Marguerite, can you explain what happened?
Well, I was inspired by my dad's, you know, love of writing, and low sales, the combination, to make a video. And I made that video and it obviously went extremely viral. I was hoping to get a few readers and we ended up getting way more than that. And it's just created this incredible, you know, this wave of the everyone loving and knowing my dad and Stone Maidens. So it's just been amazing. Excuse me.
Well, I think you may be underselling it just a hair. For those listening who aren't familiar with the story, the original 16-second TikTok video has been viewed more than 56 million times. And I checked before I got on this call, and there are over 46,000 comments on that original 16-second video. What gave you the idea to post that video about your dad and his novel?
Well, that exact video, those were kind of the places I grew up watching my dad write in that exact chair where he was sitting. And I kind of just moved around the room from different places where I used to watch him. So it was sort of a, as I've been saying, like a little micro memoir for me. And I wanted to do it because I knew he wrote a beautiful book. And I just felt like nobody knew about it. After 11 years, I was certain nobody knew about it. And, I didn't even really think that far into it. I just thought a few people would learn about it. But yeah, what happened was just magical, really.
Sure.
And worthy. I mean, he's a beautiful writer, and he's a wonderful father. He's a wonderful person. So it's sort of the perfect storm, I guess.
And I should add, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, that you know, after I mentioned earlier 56 million views, and after this 16-second video about your dad and his first novel went viral, the sales resulted in the book hitting number one on Amazon. And I wonder, before you posted that video, were you a big TikTok user yourself?
I just consume TikTok. I sometimes posted videos, and I like making videos, and like with the family and my friends, I'm always the one taking pictures. But no, I was not like in this kind of a league before at all. But sure. I do like, you know, checking out other videos. I have an interest in it in that way. But no, nothing like this before.
What's the song in the background of that initial video?
So it's a, I'm not exactly where it's from. Mm-hmm. Except, well, I know that, but it's a cover. I'm not sure exactly where the audio is from exactly, but it's a cover of John Lennon. And my dad, you know, when I think of John Lennon, he always reminds me of my dad. And when I heard that sound, I knew it was kind of, I'd heard it on a lot of videos on TikTok. And I wasn't really thinking that far, but when I made the video, actually, I posted it with a different sound. And after about an hour, it had like maybe like 10 views or something silly. I just didn't like it. And I deleted it. And I redid it again with that song. And I was like, that's it. That's perfect. Cause I heard the song and I was like, oh my God, that makes me think of my dad. And so I actually deleted it and redid the video and posted it.
That's interesting. I didn't recognize it as a Lennon cover. You said you deleted it. Then you re-recorded it with the new song behind it. After you posted it that second time, when did you yourself realize that something was happening as a result of posting this 16-second video?
Yeah, when I went to bed that night, a couple hours later, it was at like 200 views. And so that's kind of where I thought it was. And I was actually excited because he'd had like 5 followers. And I think someone said, that's how I want to read that book, because I had shown the back of the book in the video so people could read it. And I thought I was excited about that. But when I woke up in the morning, it had over 700,000 views just while we were sleeping.
Wow.
And I was like, I thought that might even be it. And I was blown away by that. But it was growing so fast and so quickly after that. I think within a day or so, it had like 15 million views. And his book already started to move on Amazon.
Sure.
Very quickly. He was number one on Amazon within 2 days of posting the video, to give you an idea of how fast it all happened. So we actually couldn't even emotionally really keep up with it. It all happened so fast. And actually, he didn't even know about it yet. So I hadn't told him.
In January, Jeff, I had 0 book sales.
Just to compare.
And who was the publisher of your debut novel? Who was the publisher?
Thomas and Mercer. They're an Amazon imprint. Yeah.
Got it. Has anyone from TikTok reached out to you? Have you talked to anyone at TikTok?
Yeah. When everything was happening, they have like, there was a few people from TikTok. There was like I guess it's like they have a bunch of different branches that'll reach out, but it was a woman who wanted to just help us. Like, she contacted us and just wanted to have a conversation. And, ask if we like had any questions about it or anything. And one, yeah, it was just, we just sort of had a meeting with her. It was sort of unofficial. I can't even remember what her exact role was. She was very nice. And we just had a FaceTime call with her. And then another like approved by TikTok company, it's called TikTok for Good, collaborated with us. And we made a video with them to kind of spread the good news. And TikTok themselves reposted our video and made like on their official page.
Right, right.
They made a video for us as well. So that was really exciting. And they comment on our videos, which is also like, you
That's
know,
amazing.
A fangirl moment.
And I wonder in your conversations with them, did they ever talk to you about kind of the virality or how the algorithm works? I mean, it's just, I mean, I'm sure they're not going to give away secrets, but I'm just curious, like how it went from 200 to 700,000.
I know. No, we weren't speaking with anyone about algorithm stuff.
Right.
I think honestly, and I don't know anything about how TikTok works, but
sure.
I think they don't even know it's going to go viral. So it's sort of like, all of
I think you're right.
They were just as surprised as us, you know? So it's a combination of, from what I understand, and I can't explain why this video invoked this, but it's a combination of how long someone will watch a video, mm-hmm. whether they like or comment, right. and then whether or not they go to your page, and then if they follow you. Those are sort of the steps. So that was happening so fast that the algorithm just kept pushing
right,
it.
Right.
Because, yeah, within like the end of the first day, I think it was like over 10 million views within a day, which is really crazy.
And yeah, that's just stunning.
I know that. I mean, we've stayed humble through all this because also this was overnight, but it was also 25 years. It was 14 years of my dad writing and 11 years of not having this. So, you know, we got to eat our humble pie for many years before this, which I think is good, you know, because
yeah,
I think.
Of course.
This isn't a typical thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lloyd, can you talk to us about what happened after all of this virality and the you know first novel hit number one on Amazon? Were you immediately contacted by book publishers? Because just to set the scene for someone listening, this happened in February, what we're talking about in terms of the video, and now we're in August and you're publishing a book through HarperCollins.
That's right. It was like my daughter just said, things escalated rapidly. Media calling. I have an agent that actually placed my first book, Stone Maidens, and she got in touch with me pretty quickly because she's in New York City and that's where a lot of the traditional publishing houses are based. And, HarperCollins was very, very interested. And
was 3 weeks after the video was posted.
Yeah, not even 3 weeks, but
maybe less.
That's when things really started to roll a little bit.
Right.
And then, of course, we were invited down to New York by the Today Show and appeared there. And that was quite exciting because I'm 75. And be honest with you, because of the pandemic, I had not really been inside. In the major city, but in a restaurant even. And I went down in February. This is really the first time I sat with my son who lives in New York City in a restaurant. And I went on the set and I have to tell you that no one, and you probably know this more than I do. No one in New York in February was wearing a mask indoors or out, it seemed. So, you know, I had that. I went in spite of that because this was so incredible.
Sure.
I felt I should go, you know, and my daughter and I enjoyed that. And then HarperCollins really wanted the book, the sequel, knew I had written one, which I finished last summer. And they very much escalated this. I mean, to think that in April, whenever they got started in the copy editing phase, it was almost like a little over 4 months, but it was very quickly.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing for traditional publishers.
Yes, it is.
So can you talk to us? I mean, you mentioned before, as we were talking, you were talking about, you know, working as a lawyer. Can you talk about your fiction writing journey and what led you to writing your first novel, Stone Maidens?
Good question. I wrote poetry in college, but just for myself, nothing to publish. And I went to law school, of course, as I mentioned, and I worked for a judge. So I was drafting opinions for him, but it was all lawyer-related documentation and writing. But when I moved to Vermont to work as a lawyer for a mid-sized life insurance company here in Montpelier, I had, during my early years here, I had this desire, probably I was around 42, 43 years old, to learn how to write. I wanted to write a book, but I didn't know anything about how to do that. So I basically worked with a professor. We have a writing college, or we did up here, Vermont College of Fine Arts. And I worked with this guy that I met there with some of my ideas. I started writing, and he helped me a lot with front story, back story, pace, dialogue. You know, he took me through what he told me after 2 years. Lloyd, you basically have an MFA, because I worked very hard. This is while I was working full time. So I would work on weekends, and after dinner at night, I would burn the candle at both ends, get up very early in the morning, and write then. I had this passion to tell this story that involved a woman being attacked in southern Indiana. And of course, the story is fiction. The way I developed it, I became interested in, I don't want to give away the nature of the book, but I became interested in several features of the characters involved, which involved a lot of research on my part to understand better the phenomenon that I was talking about. So during this time, my daughter mentioned 14 years from the beginning of the whole writing process to selling the book first, well, to convincing an agent that it was a good enough book to try to sell. It's a real undertaking, and it was one of joy. I loved the process. You know, I think for anyone that loves the process of trying to tell a story, and let me tell you, Jeff, I told it wrong every possible way you can imagine. I had no idea what I was doing half the time, and that's okay. I think making mistakes is the best thing, because I got to see, after looking at it over time and figuring it out differently, how to point of view differently. You know, I learned from trial and error, and just because I enjoy the process. I think you have to enjoy the process, because let me tell you, I had no idea that someone would buy my book. I mean, I hoped it might happen. It took me 7 months to get an agent. You know, it's very difficult.
Sure.
And all these things were stepping stones or building blocks, because they tested my desire, and I kept at it. I was determined. I just wouldn't take no for an answer.
Well, have you started thinking about or working on a third novel?
Oh, I definitely have. It's well underway. I actually wrote during the pandemic a standalone novel, which has been purchased by England. It's called The Runner. I don't know when they're going to publish it, but it could be early next year. But that is an interesting tie-in with the trilogy that I'm working on now, the third installment of the first two books, Stone Maidens and Maidens of the Cave. But it's well along the way.
That's great.
And I have to say, the reason for that is because, and I want to encourage your listeners, when my daughter made this video and it became viral, God knows why it did, though. And it instilled in me, when I read all the comments by these people on TikTok that were so positive and loving, it was almost 99% really loved the book. And that just propelled me back into, thinking that, this is something I can continue. And then that was what HarperCollins asked, would he consider a trilogy? And that was all I needed to hear. And I started work on it in the spring.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Well, given your experience taking as long as it did to, as you know, in your words, basically learn how to write a novel. What writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories or novels?
I think for me, starting from scratch, it was what I needed to do. I didn't go to an MFA program. I didn't start out trying to write short stories and take courses to learn how to do that. I jumped in with both feet and I landed on my face but I was persistent. I think persistence is key. My daughter mentions this first video that went viral. They would sit on the office where I wrote the book is on the steps to the attic. And they would frequently walk up the steps, my children, and see me at this primitive computer. Because back in the early 90s, it was an IBM. It had a green screen. It was horrible. And, you know, you could type faster than the cursor. You know, it had such low power. But in any event, that's where I started. And I think my advice is don't give up. Don't give up hope. I'm 75. It happened to me later in life. I'm happy. But I never expected it. I'm perfectly happy to accept the other direction. I just think that if you like doing something, keep at it. Because otherwise, you know, nothing happens. You know, it's always valuable to try something. And I think failure is the best success because I learned so much from my failure. You know, I wanted to improve on it.
Well, what novels have you read recently that you enjoyed?
I've read a number of books in my genre that I enjoy very much. I've reread Thomas Harris's trilogy or four books on Hannibal Lecter. I love his writing. He's a brilliant mind. I've read David Baldacci. I love Henning Mankell, who's recently deceased in the last 4 or 5 years. Wonderful. Created the character Wallander, Swedish writer. I've read lots of other books that are, you know, that are in my genre that are contemporary. I don't know how much it influences me. I know a lot of the books that have been very popular are in the first person point of view. I tend to write in the third person.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many good, gifted writers. I'm having a bit of a writer's block remembering all the names. But in the last year, I've read quite a few different books in my genre.
Sure. Well,
and I like the older ones, too. I mean, like I said, Thomas Harris and John Grisham, of course. It doesn't have to be a thriller with murder involved. Like Michael Connelly, he's very good.
Sure.
Dennis Lehane is a great writer.
Well, Marguerite, where can people find your dad online if they want to learn more about him and his novels? And can you tell the listeners where they can find the TikTok video?
Yeah, our TikTok is at Stone Maidens. And we post there regularly, and same with our Instagram, which is stone.maidens. And then we've just started Threads. We don't post there a ton.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same as Instagram. It has the same username and everything, stone.maidens. And yeah, we're pretty active on there. As long as we're still inspired to keep making videos and having fun together, which so far so good, we'll keep posting.
That's wonderful. Well, again, we've been speaking to Lloyd Devereaux Richards, author of the new novel Maidens of the Cave, and his daughter Marguerite. And the novel is available now, so go buy a copy. And Lloyd and Marguerite, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
It was Monday, March 26th, and Christine was running late, as usual. She pulled open the heavy door to the large function room on the mezzanine level of the Chicago Marriott and entered as quietly as she could. The room was dimly lit and filled with agents seated in front of a podium and overhead screen. The door closed behind Christine with a pronounced thump. Patricia Gaston, the new director of the FBI's Chicago branch, glanced up from the podium, squinting in Christine's direction, then proceeded with her comments. With the aid of a laser pointer, Gaston was reviewing a new reorg chart displayed on the screen. Christine searched for her name on the labyrinthine roster of names clustered beneath boxes representing each divisional unit of the branch office. There it was. Christine Prusik, Forensics, near the bottom of the screen, directly under the name Ned Miranda. Who the hell is he? Based on the screen diagram, the revamped structure pushed her further down the hierarchical chain. Not what she'd imagined after 14 successful years at the Bureau. Maybe Roger Thorne, the former Chicago branch director who this past winter had taken a higher-up Bureau position in Washington, had alerted the new branch director to Christine's habit of bending and, yes, she admitted, occasionally breaking the rules. She did have a tendency to go solo without keeping her superiors punctually informed, but it was only because time was of the essence in a criminal investigation. That was a truth that never changed. Christine caught a sideways glimpse of Gaston's flashy red suit when the new branch director stepped away from the podium. The director's voice found its cadence in a confident monotone as she flashed through a series of PowerPoint slides, illustrating a slew of new administrative forms. The laser pointer zigzagged in accompaniment with each new graphic, underscoring the refrain that all personnel were expected to complete these forms and deliver them in a timely fashion to the various unit heads, including Christine, head of the forensics unit, who were required to sign off promptly. Daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and annual report forms. Christine shook her head in consternation. Daily reports? What about police work? But a change in management meant putting her best foot forward, and she would give it her best shot. First impressions last longest. She could hear her mother telling her on her first day of eighth grade at St. Agnes's in Detroit. Jortza Prusik had ironed the pleated pale blue blouse of Christine's uniform early that same morning so she'd look her best. Say, yes, ma'am, when spoken to, and be sure to always smile, button your lip unless asked to speak by one of the nuns. Do you hear me, Christine? So Christine had learned the drill. Say yes, smile, and answer politely when asked a question. Unfortunately, she was never very good at that particular drill. Christine scrolled through her phone messages and emails as Gaston droned on. Her phone vibrated. It was the incoming call that she'd been expecting from Dr. Ernie Hansen, the Carbondale, Illinois medical examiner. Local Illinois police had earlier reported that a missing Lincoln Technical College student's dead body had been found on an embankment of the Little Muddy River in a remote quadrant of the Shawnee National Forest in the wilds of southern Illinois. Hansen's call to Christine had come at the recommendation of Dr. Walter Henniger from Crosshaven, Indiana, who'd said good things about Christine's crime-solving abilities based on his work with her on a particularly brutal series of murders during the preceding year. Christine exited the meeting hall to take the call in the lounge. She confirmed her arrangements to meet with the medical examiner the next day at his office in Carbondale, a smallish city of 26,000 located near the bottom of the state, not far from the confluence of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. She thought it unusual that Hansen would call in the FBI so early. Over the phone, she discerned obvious distress in the doctor's voice, an uneasy bewilderment. Whatever had caused the young victim's death, this local ME clearly wanted her assistance right now. Finishing her call with Hansen, Christine re-entered the meeting room. The overhead lights were now on, and Patricia Gaston was shaking hands and greeting agents up front. A tall, thin man with closely cropped dark hair approached Christine. He cleared his throat.
"You must be Christine Prusik," he said tentatively, as if he'd just double-checked her bureau profile picture on the computer system.
Christine held out her hand and they shook. "And you must be Ned Miranda," she said, recalling the name directly above hers on the overhead screen. He nodded and forced a quick smile, glancing back at Patricia Gaston, who was making her way toward them. Watching the slight, well-tanned woman now in charge of Chicago's bureau branch shake hands as she walked down the aisle, Christine felt a sudden apprehension. Regardless of how well-intentioned and conscientious Miranda may be in performing his duties, this younger agent was now her new boss, and she, Christine, was now twice removed from the branch office's topmost command. Whatever else this meant, it couldn't be good news. Miranda made the introductions, and the forensic anthropologist offered her hand to Gaston, whose thin fingers barely pressed the ends of Christine's. It was an awkward shake that felt, more than anything else, like a queen obliging her subject. "Ned's told me so much about you, Christine. You've quite a storied history. So many unusual cases that you've worked on."
"Why, thank you, Director Gaston," Christine said politely,
unable to tell whether she'd just been complimented or mocked. "I asked Ned to mark out some time for us all, perhaps later this week, when we could discuss the direction of the forensics unit."
Christine nodded in what she hoped was a cheerful manner.
Gaston's choice of the word direction sounded like ominous code for "it's time to dismantle and retrofit the forensics team."
"Look," Christine said, setting aside departmental worries, "I have an important matter to bring to your attention, Patricia. It really can't wait. I've received two calls from downstate, a Carbondale ME who's got a body, a young college student who'd been missing for a number of days. They found her body today under bizarre circumstances. He's requested our help. Ned, I have to run."
Gaston pressed her hand on Miranda's forearm and lifted her shiny leather briefcase from the floor.
"It was so nice meeting you, Christine."
She left the room.
"Give me a sec, Christine," Ned said, gesturing for her to wait as he followed the branch director out the door.
Christine couldn't believe her eyes and ears. Gaston hadn't shown the least bit of interest in the news of a young woman's death that fell squarely within her lawful jurisdiction. Prusik had a sinking feeling that she and her forensics team were headed for darker days. Technically speaking, Christine's field of expertise, forensic anthropology, was largely limited to the study of skeletal remains in order to decipher how a particular death may have resulted, naturally, by suicide or homicide. She was a duly certified member of the American Board of Forensic Anthropology, though she'd never felt it necessary to add the acronym ABFA to her stationery or business cards for purposes of getting her job done. If it was determined that a death had been caused by a third person or persons, it was the forensic anthropologist's job to pick up any clues that could be gleaned from the bone evidence in order to identify the cause of death and the circumstances, if possible. With any luck and a thorough examination of the site where remains are found, a good forensic anthropologist might gain some sense of the who, when, why, and how. Christine relied heavily upon the technical and scientific colleagues who composed her forensics team, and they, in turn, relied on sophisticated lab testing and software analysis to enhance any clues recovered. On those occasions involving multiple crimes of a similar nature, her team had access to the vast universe of the federal and state interlinked crime databases. Steady budgetary cutbacks,
except in the case of a few departments that were the recipients of colossal fiscal increases for the war on terror, had put pressure on all regional bureau laboratory teams to commingle resources and participate with other departments in the handling and examining of major crime scene evidence. Increasingly, therefore, Christine and her forensic team were expected to investigate all major crimes assigned to them, including the examination of dead bodies in various states of decomposition, not just skeletal remains. Christine had taken several years of postdoctoral training and become quite adept at postmortem exams. She generally welcomed the added responsibility, finding fieldwork and postmortems a challenge and an opportunity to escape the daily drudgery of desk work and the insidious torment of office politics that went with it. A minute later, Miranda came striding back into the meeting room, grooves deepening across his forehead. "What's wrong?" he said. "You look upset." "Me? Upset? That the new branch director has zero interest in a murder case in her jurisdiction?" Christine forced a chuckle, shaking her head in disapproval. "This is a significant matter, Ned, and it will most likely require our resources straight away." "Listen, Christine." Miranda stood closer to her, so not to be overheard by hotel staff busily at work cleaning the carpet. "If you'd made the meeting on time, you would have understood the reason for the new reorg chart." Miranda was right. She'd come in at the end of Patricia Gaston's remarks and only glanced at the overhead screen before ducking out to take the call from the Carbondale ME. Clearly, she'd missed something important. "Okay, then, what exactly is going on?" "Patricia has asked all unit heads, including forensics, to produce detailed technical descriptions for each position under your direct or indirect supervision. As a unit head, you are responsible to see to it that each of your direct reports completes a professional and technical qualifications profile consistent with the Hayes-Stanley worksheet in 2 weeks' time." "Professional and technical qualifications profile? What the hell is that?" Miranda gave her a cut-the-crap look. "The PTQP program is combined with the Hayes-Stanley worksheet. A software link is in an email that was already sent to you and all other agents. A click on the link, then log on, creating a unique password. The program will load and guide you and each member of your forensic team on how to address and complete the worksheet, using special metrics devised for the purpose." Christine felt suddenly fatigued. "Regardless of whether you like what I'm telling you, keep in mind, Christine, that completing it accurately and timely is crucial, as it ties directly to salary and bonus scales." Miranda paused and then added, "Oh, and one other thing. Developing the final document for your unit's reports will require your attendance at a unit head meeting to be held twice a week until completion." Filling out forms was foreign to her DNA. Christine abhorred chain of command speak and the accompanying hierarchical administration, who reports to whom, that invariably brings a slowdown in the field, if not a complete stoppage, as now apparently would be the case, she feared. Getting her real job done took precedence. It just had to. "Come on, Ned. The local police depend on us. So now what? I'm supposed to fill out a form telling you of a crime scene needing our investigative assistance? And then you go tell Patricia and wait for Patricia to tell you that she'll get back to you about it? Then you come tell me to wait until, what, a form is stamped?" She hadn't meant to sound so strident. She burned to get going to the Carbondale ME's office. Miranda's cheeks flushed. "Lose the sarcasm, Christine. It won't work with me. I'm not telling you how to do your job. This initiative is a separate task, in addition to your normal duties, and compulsory, I might add." An older woman in a maid's uniform was tugging on her cleaning cart. A wheel had gotten stuck on the lip of the carpet. Christine helped the woman lift the machine free. "Gracias," the woman said. "De nada," Christine replied, stepping over to a large exterior window to get away from the vacuuming noises. Cars were crossing the Chicago River below. Miranda followed her to the side of the meeting hall. "I apologize for sounding brusque," she said. If I've learned anything in my years here, it's that cooperation from a skilled working team is of vital importance. We need to be able to function together. It's these non-essential aspects, the endless busy work that tends to muck things up. Do you know what I mean, Ned? Miranda briefly closed his eyes, then popped them back open and checked his watch. Unfortunately, I've got to run now. I'll catch up with you this afternoon and we can discuss it more then. He strode off, leaving her standing in the hall while the cleaning crew bustled around her.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.